The unsurpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May we unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth.
I want to present to you Shoryu Bradley, who grew up in Texas and first practiced at Austin Zen Center.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Then later at San Shinji in Indiana with Shohaku Okamura, and he received Dharma transmission from Shohaku-san. He did monastic training at both Tassajara and at Shogoji, and has a temple, Gyobutsuji, in the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas. And the nearest city I think that most people would know is Fayetteville. Is that true?
Right. Yeah. Yes.
There's a tiny little town that you mentioned, but
right.
I don't think anybody else knows it.
No. The name is Kingston, but very different from the Kingston we probably think of in Jamaica. It's a very different setting.
So, yeah. Let's welcome Shoryu-san.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here. And I really appreciate Zuiko inviting me here, and it's great to be back here. Well, this morning, I'm going to put my glasses on here for the whole talk, so forgive me for that, I think. I would like to talk mainly about fire. That's what this talk is going to be turning out to be about, mainly. But I've been interested lately in the different kind of allegories and metaphors that Buddhism has developed for the self. And basically, of course, we know that Buddhism is the study of the self. Dogen Zenji said that, of course, and it's just a well-known tenet, of course, a foundation of Buddhism, that the study of the self is the foundation of our practice. So I wanted to talk from a little bit from the early texts from the Pali Canon. I really like this sermon. It's a very well-known sermon, an important one, called the Fire Sermon. And let me just go ahead. Actually, before I do that, I might say, maybe familiar with this teaching, but one of the basic teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, was that essentially the self is just a combination of events that come together, of course. One of the things he said was that there's a sense organ here, there's an object there, and when those two things meet, something happens. Basically, consciousness comes up. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, taste. But the mind is also considered a sense organ too. So this is the same foundation for the arising of the self in the mind. And so that's what he's talking about here in the Fire Sermon. And let me read most of that for you. Of course, the Buddha's here. It goes into how he's addressing the monks. And he says, "Monks, all is burning. And what, monks, is the all that is burning? The eye is burning. Forms are burning. Eye consciousness is burning. Eye contact is burning. And whatever feeling arises with eye contact as condition, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of lust, the fire of hatred, with the fire of delusion. Burning with birth, aging, and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair, I say. The ear is burning, the mind is burning, and whatever feeling arises with mind contact as condition, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of lust, with the fire of hatred, with the fire of delusion. Burning with birth, aging, and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair, I say. Seeing thus, monks, the instructive noble disciple becomes disenchanted with the eye, with forms, with eye consciousness, with eye contact, with whatever feeling arises with eye contact as condition, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, becomes disenchanted with the ear, with the mind, with whatever feeling arises with mind contact as condition. Becoming disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, his mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there becomes the knowledge it is liberated. He understands destroyed is birth. The spiritual life has been lived. What has to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. So basically the Buddha here is saying that he's presenting the self from a certain perspective, and he's saying we're in quite a fix, actually, because every experience we have, the foundation of it is burning with this greed, hate, and delusion. There's nothing we can actually experience that doesn't contain this on some level. The thing that struck me about this the last time I read this on my own was that he said that everything in the chain is burning. It's not only the consciousness that arises, but the subject, the object, the contact, all of this is suffused with this reaction. So to me, it's very interesting. It says that actually what we're doing here right now is part of that process, the teaching itself, what the Buddha said, and the words that we speak are all burning with this greed, hate, and delusion, whether we realize it, you know, or not. We'll come back to that in just a second, but I wanted to talk about this burning, and of course, what it means to us in our everyday life, how we can usually experience it or usually acknowledge it or see it come up. It's a very powerful reaction, of course, when the self arises in some kind of unpleasant situation. We're all familiar with this, I think. I'm thinking of this situation that happened to me many years ago now. And I was just driving my car somewhere down the highway. And for some reason, the driver or the people in the car next to me thought that I had done something wrong or stupid, I guess. I didn't really know exactly what was happening, but there was a teenager in the back seat, and as I drove by, he shot me in the finger, And the emotion that came up in that, it was amazing. Like, I got so angry, and I'd never met this person before. I didn't know what his background was, or I didn't even know why he was doing that to me. But I really understood, like, how some people could go into road rage. I didn't, at that time. I don't carry a gun in my vehicle. I don't plan to do that. But, I could see that this is a very intense feeling, of course, that's hard to control sometimes. So that's very obvious. But the same route, the Buddha said, happens when we're having our morning coffee, or when we're enjoying a hot chocolate, or any pleasurable experience too, is suffused with this burning. And even a neutral reaction, a reaction that we don't even notice, or something that doesn't create any kind of emotional feeling in us, he said is also burning with greed, hate, and delusion. So that's a very deep subject that could be talked about a lot, but I think that the main thing that he's pointing to here is that we have some feeling or understanding, of course, even when we're having an experience that we enjoy, that it's not going to last. And there's just that little feeling that we're going to have to go back to regular old self, or something's going to go down and we're not going to be enjoying ourselves again. And the neutral part is very interesting to me too. Even a neutral reaction to me says that just this relationship in itself, the subject-object relationship that comes up in this reaction, is problematic. That it's reinforcing our idea that we're separate, that we're independent, or and that we have an object there and that I'm here. So, and of course we all have had the experience probably of something that's good. We judge it good for a while, and then later we don't judge it good. We judge it bad or neutral, or something neutral becomes very, you know, important to us at some point. You probably all have this experience. So there's no ultimate reality that we can place on those objects, and everything is always changing. So of course the problem here with the subject-object relationship is, in a human being, usually, is that this burning that he's talking about is our motivation when we interact with these objects. So usually an object that we like, we grasp it. Something we don't like, we try to push it away. And it's not a good strategy for life, because nothing is stable, of course, and we can't control everything, and things are changing. So we're going to create suffering for ourselves and others sooner or later if we use this as a philosophy, or not even a philosophy, just an approach to life. And that's usually what human beings do. It's just this basic get what you want and try to avoid what you don't like. So what can we do? The Buddha says that everything we experience is suffering. And of course, you know, all of the Buddhist tradition has been expounded upon this issue. But one of the allegories that was developed later that I'd like to talk about in Mahayana Buddhism, later, much later than this sermon was given, comes from the Lotus Sutra. And you might be familiar with it. It's the parable of the burning house. And so I thought it was interesting, because the burning, I think, is just taken to the next extreme. This house is the self on fire, burning. And if you can bear with me, I'll go ahead and read this one too. I think that they can that it can be expounded in the Lotus Sutra a lot better than I can tell it off the cuff. So it should just take a minute. I won't read the whole thing, but just the core of it. We might all be familiar with it, but just read that.
I have given Dharma talks on this, and I don't know if the people who are here at the moment were here then.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you're good, so that we're probably familiar with it then. Do I need to read it then?
Yes,
or,
I think it would be great to read
it. Okay. All right.
I want to hear it.
Okay, good. Me too. It always helps to hear it again. So here, the Buddha is talking to Shariputra, one of his main disciples, one of his most important disciples. And he says, Shariputra, suppose in a certain kingdom, city, or town, there is a great elder, old and worn, of boundless wealth, and possessing many fields, houses, slaves, and servants. His house is spacious and large, having only one door, and with many people dwelling in it, 100, 200, or even 500 in number. Its halls and chambers are decayed and old, its walls crumbling, the bases of its pillars rotten, the beams and roof tree toppling and dangerous. On every side, at the same moment, fire suddenly starts and the house is in flames. The sons of the elder, say 10, 20, or 30, or even 30, are in this dwelling. The elder, on seeing this conflagration spring up on every side, is greatly startled and reflects thus: though I am able to get safely out of this burning house, my children in the burning house are pleasurably absorbed in amusements, without apprehension, knowledge, surprise, or fear. Though the fire is pressing upon them and pain and suffering are imminent, they do not mind or fear and have no impulse to escape. Shariputra, this elder ponders thus: I am strong in my body and arms. Shall I get them out of the house by means of a flour vessel or a bench or a table? Again he ponders: this house has only one gate. Moreover, it is narrow and small. My children are young, knowing nothing as yet, and attached to their place of play. Perchance they will fall into and be burned in the fire. I must speak to them on this dreadful matter, warning them that the house is burning, and that they must come out instantly, lest they be burned and injured by the fire. Having reflected thus, according to his thoughts, he notifies his children: come out quickly, all of you. Though the father, in his pity, lures and admonishes with kind words, the children, joyfully attached to their play, are unwilling to believe him, and have neither surprise nor fear, nor any mind to escape. Moreover, they do not know what is the fire he means, or what the house is, and what he means by being lost, but only run hither and thither in play, glancing at their father. Then the elder reflects thus: this house is burning in a great conflagration. If I and my children do not get out at once, we shall certainly be burned up by it. Let me now, by some tactful means, cause my children to escape this disaster. Knowing that to which each of his children is predisposed, and all of the various attractive playthings and curiosities to which their natures will joyfully respond, the father informs them thus, saying: the things which you are fond of playing with, so rare and precious, if you do not come and get them, you will be sorry for it afterward. Such a variety of goat carts, deer carts, and bullock carts is now outside the gate to play with. All of you must come quickly out of this burning house, and I will give you whatever you want. Thereupon the children, hearing of the attractive playthings mentioned by their father, and because they suit their wishes, every one eagerly, each pushing the other and racing against each other, comes out scrambling of the burning house. Then the elder, seeing his children have safely escaped and are all in the square, sits down in the garden, no longer troubled, but with a mind at ease and ecstatic with joy. Then each of the children says to their father, "Father, please now give us those lovely things you promised us to play with: goat carts, deer carts, and bullock carts." Shariputra, then the elder gives to each of his children equally a great cart, lofty and spacious, adorned with the precious things, surrounded with railed seats, hung with bells on its four sides, and covered with curtains, splendidly decorated also with various rare and precious things, linked with strings of precious stones, hung with garlands of flowers, thickly spread with beautiful mats, supplied with rosy pillows, yoked with white bullocks of pure white skin, of handsome appearance and of great muscular power, which walk with even steps and with the speed of the wind, having also many servants and followers to guard them. Wherefore, because this great elder is of boundless wealth, and all of his various treasures and granaries are full to overflowing, so he reflects thus: my possessions being boundless, I must not give my children inferior small carts. All these children are my sons, whom I love without partiality. Having such great carts made of the precious seven, infinite in number, I should with equal mind bestow them on each one without discrimination. Wherefore, because if I gave them to the whole nation, these things of mine would not run short. How much less to my children. Meanwhile, each of the children rides on his great cart, having got that which he had never had before and never expected to have. So I'll stop there. And there are so many things in this story that could be talked about and have been talked about. But I'll just focus on a few things. Of course, this story is... let's see, am I supposed to stop at 10:20?
Between 10:20 and 10:30.
Okay, it's already 10. It's already 10:20. I can't believe it.
10:30. Whenever you'd like okay. to stop is when we'll stop.
We'll adjust.
Yeah.
All right, the time went fast. I'll talk a little bit, and then I'll have tomorrow to talk to you about it. So, of course, this story is often taught about the tradition, the evolving of the Mahayana, or the great vehicle tradition, and it's an explanation of what's called skillful means or tactful means, as the sutra says. So I think this arose in reaction to the way Buddhism developed, that it seemed for a while that there were just a bunch of monks holed up in monasteries practicing for themselves. And so this is one theory anyway. This movement evolved so that there would be more people involved in the object of practice would include other people, not just a select elite group of people devoted to a monastery. And so the goat cart is typically, we say that's the sravaka, or the hearing vehicle, the people who actually heard the Buddha speak, early Buddhism, which the sutra says is geared towards your own enlightenment. And then we have the deer cart, which is the pratyeka Buddha, who gets enlightenment without a teacher and doesn't teach, but he's just, he or she is just self-enlightened. And the bullock cart represents the Mahayana, the great vehicle, or the Bodhisattva vehicle, in which our practice is devoted to saving all beings. And but what I wanted to focus on more than the skillful means, actually I won't mention the skillful means so much, because it's talked about a lot, and basically it's saying that the teaching was expressed in some way for people according to their capacity, and then it would change, and it's offered to people according to what they need. But it's all part of the one great vehicle of the Buddha. But one of the most interesting things about the parable to me is the fact that all the kids are playing with toys. And actually, I hadn't realized this before, I hadn't thought about it, but Uchiha Roshi had a very famous teaching about playing with toys. And he said that we play with toys all of our life. It's a process of playing with one toy when you're a kid, and then just the toys get bigger and varied as you grow up as an adult. But I think this is related to the fire sermon. Basically, the Buddha was saying the same thing, that everything actually that we experience, we approach as a toy. Unless we're, unless we have some other way to approach it. So the subject-object relationship itself, we can look at as a toy player and playee, I guess. Mm-hmm. The thing manipulated and the thing that's playing with that's manipulated. So there's obvious toys that we have, many of us have in this culture. Of course, materialism, stuff, social achievement, vocational development or career development. People use this for just their own playthings to, bolster up the self. Romance, fashion, TV, movies, novels, sports, music, etc., etc. And not that I'm saying that any of these things are bad in themselves, that you know, I'm not trying to give you a fire and brimstone teaching that that these are evil, but usually we use these things as toys to buffer us from our genuine experience, from the reality that we're actually experiencing. But what really is problematic about the toy culture or playing with toys? Well, I think about in these terms. Have you ever been in a household, in a wealthy household, or not necessarily wealthy actually, but just in a household where they really focus on the young children getting gifts, and they have a stack of gifts this high, and it gets to the point where it's just this kind of craze. You open up one, okay, you kind of throw it over your shoulder, and you go to the next one, they go to the next one, and you know, it's just a matter of going to the next thing without actually seeing what you've gotten almost and by the end. And then it's often, to me, I think about, and I've seen this happen, how many of the toys the kids are actually playing with from the Christmas before, from that pile that they opened up, it's probably very few that they're still playing with. So this is what we can do. We play with a toy for a while. It loses its luster. We toss it aside and we look for another one. And we scramble, you know, for another toy. This is the way we create suffering for ourselves and for other people. And we treat everything in our life as an object. And so this is not addressing the self. The reality of what the self actually is saying, I'm here and I'm going to manipulate this. But actually, everything around us is creating our experience of self. But the toy mentality completely denies that. And for example, I was surprised some weeks ago when I was in Texas visiting my parents. And so I often watch TV when I'm in a household like that to kind of see what's going on. And the top story at that time was that the latest iPhone was coming out. It was on the national news. It was the big, I think it was the top story that the new iPhone was coming out. And I thought, wow, you know, that's the biggest story in the nation tonight. So there's nothing wrong in itself of having a new iPhone, but I had to ask myself, where are all the old phones going every time one of these new ones comes out? And I did a little bit of research, and it turns out that 91% of Americans, adult Americans, own a cell phone. And this, I just realized my numbers here are a little faulty because that's adult Americans, but there are almost 316 million people in the United States. So the average person gets a new cell phone every 18 months.
Wow.
So I thought it was near 288 million phones, but it may not be that many because it's over 200 million, I'm sure. Every year are somehow not used, and only 10% of them are recycled, it turns out. And cell phones contain toxic materials such as lead, cadmium, nickel, lithium. And when you place those in a landfill, these toxins leach out and contaminate the soil and even drinking water. And that's, I think, due to the toy mentality. But I did, in saying that, though, I did hear that some of the old ones were being converted to microscopes or something. You know, I think there's an effort to try to address this problem, but it is a real issue. I'll just talk about one more toy. It's almost 10:30, and then we can talk about more toys tomorrow. And then how to address the toy issue, which I think is our practice is of Zazen, is how we address this issue. But another classic example, I think, in American culture especially, is the automobile. You know, we love our automobiles. And I grew up in car culture, and and I totally participated in it. It's our basic form of transportation, but the significance for us goes way beyond that, and the relationship they have to the self arising goes way beyond that. And so I read on the internet the other day that SUVs and crossovers, I guess station wagons-like vehicles, took over as the most popular type of vehicle sold for the first time in the U.S. Bigger vehicles. And that the average fuel mileage of vehicles being sold has dropped over the past few months. And this is all because gas prices went down. But it's not horrible. You know, it's not as horrible as it sounds because of government regulation and so forth. The average gas mileage of vehicles has gone way up over the past years. Emissions are down, you know, but that's mainly due to government regulation. But the technology is put into more power, a lot of it, more power and, you know, more bells and whistles, more toys. But this the study that I consulted linked this to the change to a drop in gas prices, which are 15 cents lower than they were at this time a year ago. And some people trade in their vehicles almost as often as they get a new cell phone. I know people who do that. So this is a very powerful toy, and it can be very destructive, of course, the effects that they have on the environment and many effects, rather, even beyond just the emissions are involved, you know, in making the vehicles and disposing of them. It's a huge cost to the environment. But I'm not, you know, I'm by no means not involved in this. The monastery was so fortunate, and I'm so grateful that just recently we were given a truck, a new truck, and we need it desperately. You know, if we're living out in the country, it's a basic tool that you really need. And I got snowed in 3 times last year because I didn't have a three-wheel drive vehicle. So now, I mean, a four-wheel drive vehicle. Works better than a three-wheel drive. So you know, it's very good news, and it's a bigger vehicle. It does get lower gas mileage. Sometimes you need a bigger vehicle to get the job done. There's no doubt about that. But this is a big shiny new truck, and I've been surprised on the effect that it's had on me at times. The latent impulses that seem to come around for buying stuff for it. You know, I keep finding things that we really need this to make sure the truck's going to be, you know, last a while, and doesn't have anything to do with just, you know, my ego, of course. It's all about my ego. But I, of course, I'm trying to practice with it, but, you know, my inner cowboy, I guess, is coming out. Every guy raised in Texas has their inner cowboy that arises when they get in a new truck, maybe. I don't know. But I've never been a truck person. I've never owned a truck. I never knew, you know, that I ever had an interest in a truck. But here it is. And, you know, it's very seductive. But one of the most seductive things about it are when I drive into town in this truck, this big new shiny truck in rural Arkansas, you know, in a town in the rural area, I know that the way that I'm perceived is way different than, for example, the way that I was perceived when I was driving my 1980 Volkswagen Rabbit that I had. Yeah, I'm a completely different person, almost, in my own mind, mainly because, I mean, I think there's more than this going on, but the way that I think that others see me, but the way the vehicle actually makes you feel is different too. Being high up and powerful in a big four-wheel drive truck is different than being in a, you know, a beater.
And you no longer have to play part facing down on an incline so you can start the vehicle.
Right. Hopefully. Hopefully. That's right. Which I had to do last year when I was here. So I never knew that Rabbit was going to start, or it didn't start on that trip unless I did that, actually. So But this is something to practice with, and it's the self-arising. We're all collectively, you know, involved in it. The people that we meet in the culture, the people who make the truck, the people doing the advertising, the research, and then, you know, all of it is producing a reaction. And so that's maybe a good stopping point for this talk. And I'm sorry I went over a little bit, but we'll talk more about this tomorrow.
The unsurpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May we, meaning of the Tathagata's truth.